Well, okay. Some of you may have seen the philosopher Thomas Nagel's recent book called Mind and Cosmos, where he, to the surprise and dismay of many of us, he came out expressing his disbelief in evolution. For such a distinguished philosopher to articulate and defend such a naive view is very surprising to many of us. But you could sort of see it coming in his own work over the years. And in particular, a few years before that, he, in the Times Literary Supplement, in the issue where they have their annual what's the best book you've read this year that they send out to about 100 authors, write a short paragraph about the best book they read that year. And Tom decided that it was a book called Signature in the Cell by Stephen Meyer, and which he lauded as a breath of fresh air and a very clear and sincere, wonderful book. Well, this is a work of propaganda by the director of the Discovery Institute, a creationist. This is the intelligent design movement. And Tom fell for Meyer's book, Hook, Line, and Sinker. And I read Meyer's book, and I could see why, because Meyer makes a case that this is the origin of life. It's about the origin of life. And Meyer purports to survey the research on origin of life, which has been going on for 50 years and more, and finding it an embarrassment because of stumbling and just failure and this the complete intractability of this problem. Well, it can be made to appear that way, but if you actually talk to the people in the field, you find out that Meyer's book is remarkable largely for the things that he simply neglects to tell you about that are true, that are he has swept under the rug. And of course, if you're not an expert in the field, you won't know, you won't be able to see these dogs that do not bark, and you will be unable to judge. By the way, this is a lesson that I have learned myself. I've been asked several times in recent years to read and comment on and either endorse or rebut, oh, for instance, one conspiracy theory or another, or say what was responsible for the fall of the World Trade Center. And my response to that is, I don't have the expertise. I'm sure you can make a very strong and compelling case to a non-expert, but I don't know what you're leaving out. And so I simply am not in a position to make a judgment about this because I don't know the field. And only if you know the field do you know enough to be able to see where important facts have been swept under the rug. Sidney Brenner, the wonderful, irrepressible evolutionary biologist, molecular biologist, has christened this move Occam's Broom. Not Occam's Razor, but Occam's Broom. Occam's Broom is what you use to sweep inconvenient facts under the rug. And it is often used even by reputable scientists. So the thing about Occam's Broom is that unless you're an expert in the field, you can't tell where it's being used because you can't see what isn't there. And so it's certainly true that a non-supernatural origin of life can look impossible. How did that start in that diagram of the tree of life? How did that get started? It can look like an intractable mystery, which is the point of Meyer's book. And this is an illusion, I think, engendered largely by failures of imagination. So what I'm going to do now is not walk you through the latest work in origin of life research, first because I don't know it well enough myself, but I want to give you some ideas, some perspectives to put it in context. And I want to talk first about cycles. Cycles is a very interesting concept. A cycle is any process that starts and does something and does something and does something, and then it's back to the beginning again, and then it can do it again. And it gets restored somehow, and then it can happen. And when you start looking around at nature, you see that there are lots of cycles that run at different tempos, have different time courses, and do different things at different scales. And I want us to think briefly about this world of cycles in the prebiotic world, that is, before there was life on the planet, back in that period when this was a lifeless planet. What kind of world was it? It wasn't just chaos. If you think that it's just a random buzzing around of atoms and molecules, then you're impoverishing your imagination and not recognizing how much structure is there. And the particular sort of structures that we want to look at are, I think, cycles. First of all, we just have the laws of physics. And they're, in a way, sort of tedious and boring because they just describe these inexorable physical phenomena. But then look what gets built on top of them. We have thousands, probably I should say millions, I never bothered to make an estimate, of asynchronous cycles, that is, cycles which are not all in unison, all, not all coming back to the same place at the same time. Just want to remind you of a few of them. There are the seasons. There are the tides. There's the water cycle. Night and day. And then, at a different scale entirely, chemical cycles repeating in milliseconds. These are just chemical reactions that run little cycles, and they just run wherever the conditions are right. So we have all of these wheels turning within wheels, turning within wheels. It's sort of like epicycle theory, Ptolemaic theory of astronomy, but this is not invented, but discovered and quite easily traceable by science. So what do these cycles do? Think of them, if you like, I like to, as do loops. It's a term from programming. It's a cycle. A do loop is a little bit of programming, a little bit of algorithm, which says do X until Y. So the simplest do loop maybe is a counter. You put the number 27 or 38 or 119 in a register, and you say, increment it again and again until it goes to zero. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off. All right, that's a do loop. But of course, the interesting do loops don't just have a counter, but they have something else happening, and every time it comes around to zero again, every time it comes around to the top of the cycle, then it decrements the counter and does it again, and it does it n times. Or it doesn't have a counter, but it has some condition it's looking for, in a sense of looking for, but it's just designed to keep going until something happens, and then maybe to start up another cycle. And programming has lots and lots and lots and lots of loops. These are not really strange loops, but they're loops. In fact, they're not strange at all, but they are wonderful. And what they do is they generate novel probabilities. Now, here's a very improbable state of affairs. This is a beach in Maine on an island near where I have my summer place. And it's called Boom Beach because when there's a storm, it sounds like thunder. And it sounds like thunder because these rocks are all being tossed by the storm waves, the surf, as it lands on the beach. Now, these rocks are from about this size to about egg size to some of them smaller. And they're all, as you can see, are almost all beautifully, some of them are almost perfect spheres, egg shapes. They're marvels. And this beach has got just, I don't know, millions of them, probably. It's an amazing, they're all piled up. It looks like a pile has been assembled there by some giant for some purpose. Entirely abiotic. No biology, no critter, no mind, no purpose. This is just a remarkable collection of otherwise improbable objects generated by mindless physical cycles. In this case, we need the water cycle, we need the seasons, we need the tides, we need storms. That'll do it. And it doesn't take all that long. This beach is only, it's less than 100,000 years old. So it's not, in geological time, it's not very long. Peter Godfrey Smith has written a wonderful book called Darwinian Populations and Natural Selection. And I'm going to introduce a thinking tool that he introduces in the book. And I'll just have to spend a little time getting you used to it because I'm going to be using this thinking tool again and again in these lectures. It's what he calls a Darwinian space. And this is his first diagram. Can you read it? Is it legible? Well, I will help you with it. So, what he's doing in these spaces, and we'll look at several of them, is he's taking three ways in which phenomena can vary and putting them on the three dimensions of a cube, X, Y, and Z, or Z, and then placing places in this cube depending on what their values are for those three variables. And you can shift the variables. They all are variables having something to do with evolutionary processes. And the chief beauty of these diagrams is that you can see at a glance that there are phenomena that are perfectly real that are not perfect examples of evolution by natural selection. They're imperfect examples. They're quasi. They are not full strength on all three dimensions. And that's what's going to be important. So let's walk through this first one together. The three dimensions that are on here, H here, that's fidelity of heredity. This is very important for evolution. When genes are copied, they're copied, the code is copied almost perfectly. If it was perfectly copied, evolution would come to a stop. There have to be mistakes to accumulate, mutations. A mutation is a copying error. But you've got to keep the mutation rate low or the copying error low. If it gets too high, the following thing happens. Nature may find a wonderful innovation, but it disappears by erosion of error before it can be selected for to go to fixation. The accumulation of exemplars of this new feature happens not fast enough given the error rate in the transmission so that evolution stops. And that's called the error catastrophe. And that's a term of hypercycles in Munich. What's his name? Suddenly I've forgotten it. Well, I can't remember. No, it's not from catastrophe theory. Not René Thom. The error catastrophe is, it's the hypercycles man, and I suddenly blocked on his name. Oh, well, you can look it up. I'm not going to talk about him anymore. So you see, on this wall, on the left-hand wall, is where you don't have high-fidelity copying. Where that happens, you don't get evolution. So you're only going to get evolution over here near the right-hand wall, where on the H dimension, copying fidelity is high. That is a requirement for evolution. Another requirement for evolution, B, is dependence of realized fitness differences on intrinsic properties. It's S. That's on this dimension here. Now, what does that mean? It means that the selection of whatever is being selected is in virtue of a competence or a feature that's intrinsic to the things that are being reproduced, not a happenstance. My favorite example of a non-intrinsic feature is a coin-tossing tournament. Suppose we had a coin-tossing tournament in this room. You pair off two by two, flip a coin, one person wins. If you win, you go to the next round. After eight rounds or so, there would be a winner. That would be somebody who had just won eight coin tosses in a row. Pretty good. What are the chances that that person will go on winning in the next round? 50-50. Luck is not an intrinsic property, as it were, by definition. This is maybe a point worth driving home. I use the example in Darwin's Dangerous Idea. Suppose that we decided that we were going to settle our differences with Russia or China. No war, we're going to have a coin toss in Geneva. And we want to know, who do we send to be our representative? And somebody says, well, let's have a giant elimination tournament of all 300 million people in America. Whoever wins that tournament, we'll send that person as our official representative. That's foolish, because it's not an intrinsic property of whoever wins. So that's a property that you want to have high, intrinsicness, but you can have something that is short on that. Let me just do the other dimension, and I'll give you an example of that. And then C, we have continuity, which is smoothness of fitness landscape. The fitness landscape is Sewell Wright's idea. It's if you think about all the different variants that there might be of some feature. Let's take height. No, let's not, because then it'll confuse it with height in the landscape. Let's take speed. So we've got all these Zoe bunny rabbits. And to a first approximation, to be faster is better. You escape foxes better if you're faster. So if we had a whole population, and if there was variation in speed, then we would see that if A is faster than B, and if B is faster than A and C is faster than B, then C is going to be fitter in the fitness landscape than A. In general, faster is better, and even faster still is better still. That's continuity. If you have, and we can arrange this in a landscape and say the peak in the landscape, if you have a hill, This is the maximum value for this. And in general, evolution is very good at climbing hills by taking small, incremental, gradual steps. If you don't have a smooth landscape, if you don't have a continuous landscape, if you have a very jagged landscape, then it's very hard for evolution to work, because small steps taken in any direction are as likely to jump off a cliff as to be moving upward. It's very hard. The shape of the fitness landscape matters to how evolution works, and that's that dimension. So now we have three dimensions. We have intrinsicness here, we have smoothness of landscape here, and we have fidelity there. Now, these are three of the most basic dimensions of difference that we could look at evolution at. And here, up in the top, is our paradigm case, maxed out on all three values. Well, not quite maxed out, because you want to have not perfect fidelity. That's where you get paradigm case of evolution. And the textbooks will say, evolution requires necessary conditions are intrinsicness of feature, smoothness of landscape, high fidelity. Right, that gives us a paradigm case of evolution. But what about phenomena that are not quite there? They're evolution-like. They're like natural selection. They're sort of quasi-Darwinian. And here's a good example, human cells. There's a process in human development where the cells are multiplying, multiplying, multiplying. That looks like evolution. You're getting a lot of candidates. And there's a selection process going on. In development, some cells are staying on and having offspring, and some cells are dying. Before you're born, or at your birth, let's say, you have many, many more neurons in your brain than you're going to have in a month. They're not wired up properly yet. The ones that are wired up right live. The ones that aren't die, and their materials are reused in the next generation. So you have waves. It's very much like evolution, but it's not an intrinsic property. The neurons are all alike. They differ only in that property that the real estate agents tell us is important. Location, location, location. If you're in the right place, you live. If you're not, you die. Well, that's sort of a bit of luck. It's not an intrinsic feature of you. Or it's sort of intrinsic. It's not as non-intrinsic as luck. But it's not, as it were, prowess. It's not power. It's just location. But so that's a very evolutionary process, and many of the insights of Darwinian thinking work beautifully in embryological development and in development of the brain, for instance. But it's not a pure paradigm case. Drift down here is where you have high fidelity replication. You have you have a relatively indiscriminate fitness landscape. And let's see, what else have we got here? And no selection for cause at all. But you get by sheer, that's sort of like a coin tossing tournament. You can have things going to fixation, even though for no reason at all, just a historical accident. So that's where drift comes. It's an evolutionary phenomenon, but it's not natural selection. In a way, it's natural selection, but it's not Darwinian in the sense that it's not adaptationist. It's not enhancing. It's just fixing. Okay, that's our first diagram. Now, I'm going to change the dimensions entirely. This is another of Peter's diagrams. Now we have a bottleneck, a reproductive specialization, a germ-soma distinction, and we have overall integration. So overall integration is on here, bottleneck is here, and reproductive specialization is here. Let's look at a buffalo herd. Do herds of buffalo have offspring? Well, yeah, they do, sort of. They can divide in two and then go off, and then they can become this one. They're sort of, it's sort of like an amoeba dividing. You get two daughter herds, and then they can have, there can be granddaughter herds and so forth. And if they get isolated from each other, they become individualized, and they can develop even genetic differences among them. It's like speciation. So that's a kind of reproduction. You once had one herd, and now you've got four or eight or seven herds. One goes extinct. Buffalo herds, but they don't have a germ soma distinction. Any two buffaloes, one male, one female, can go off and start a herd, whereas no two cells in, no cells in your body can go off and make another person. They have to be so-called germline cells. Egg and sperm are the only, up till now, the only cells that you can make offspring of. Cloning, of course, is where you violate that. And of course, we can clone, in this sense, trees. You can take scion wood from an apple tree and graft it onto another tree and make a clone of that, or you can just take a branch and plant it in the ground and it may grow. So there's lots of variation in the real world and whether there's a germline soma line, and in many cases you can have both, of course. You can both propagate by seeds, that's germline, or propagate by scions, by grafts, you can't cut off somebody's arm and plant it in a flower pot and get a person. But you can do that with many plants. So those are those dimensions. An interesting case is the aspen rammet. An aspen grove of trees is really one big individual connected underground through roots. And it counts, from some biological purposes, as a single individual, not as a grove of individuals, because it's propagated by roots that spread out underground. Okay. Do you get the idea then? We could put other dimensions. You'll see I'm going to start putting some other dimensions on here so that we can look at the intermediate cases. Slime molds are interesting because they have a sort of reproductive specialization in that when times get tough, they congregate, the individual slime mold cells congregate and create this stalk, and some of them become, in effect, germline cells and propagate out into the world to make new colonies of slime mold. But in other times, they don't do that. So they sometimes have a germ soma distinction, and sometimes they don't. All right, on we go to the next one. Now we're where I want to be for this particular talk. This is looking at the prebiotic world. And you see up in the upper right-hand corner, I have bacteria. Bacteria are reproducing Darwinian entities for certain. They meet all the criteria. Once you get to a bacterium, life has begun. A bacterium or an archaeum, either one of them is, we're off to the races of life. We've got reproduction, we've got the whole works. But what about, how do you get to that first bacterium? That's the question of the origin of life. So what we see are three key dimensions here, which I put on there. This is energy capture. A bacterium has a metabolism. It has a systematic way of capturing energy from the world and using it to run its business, to power its machinery. On this dimension, I've put persistence versus reproduction. You don't get reproduction until you've got a bacterium. But you have sort of like reproduction, sort of halfway between mere persistence and reproduction, which is a little bit like the difference between the aspen trees. Is that growth or reproduction? You plant an aspen tree and they spread out over the hill. Are the new aspens daughters or organs? Is this a larger and larger single organism? Is that reproduction or just growth? And persistence reproduction is a similar sort of dimension where you have to get to reproduction, but how do you get there? And here I'm putting complexity on here. Now, you see, you could put other dimensions on here, but this is what I wanted to do. And I want to look, so now we have a space in which to imagine the origin of life. And we realize we have to start in the abiotic world where there's no reproduction, there's very little of the complexity we need, and energy capture. There's energy, but there's no systematic concentration and use of energy. And somehow we got to get from here to there. And when we look to there to see what's there, we see that a bacterium, this is, you know, a modern one, one we look at under the microscope today, it's one complicated thing. It's very elegantly designed. It's a brilliant piece of machinery with lots of moving parts. Not as complicated as a eukaryotic cell, but still pretty impressive. And we're inclined to think, my gosh, how could you ever get to that from a prebiotic world? And that's what we want to look at. How on earth could that much elegant complexity be put together without benefit of reproduction? Because after all, Darwinian evolution requires differential reproduction. Until you've got succession of generations, where are you going to get design improvement? Where are you going to get accumulation of complexity and refinement of energy capture? It looks, as the way I've put it so far, as if this is just impossible. We have to ring in the intelligent designer to put his godlike hand in there and arrange things, because genuine Darwinian evolution requires reproduction, and reproduction requires complexity. So how is the complexity and the energy capture going to accumulate without reproduction? And the answer is, you want to be Darwinian about Darwinism itself. This is a lesson that Godfrey Smith specifically draws. You want to be Darwinian about Darwinian processes and realize that that doesn't have an essence either. That there are quasi-Darwinian processes. There are processes which are sort of like Darwinian evolution, sort of like a mammal, but not a mammal. Not classic paradigm evolution, but quasi-Darwinian process. And that's just what we're going to look at. Darwinian evolution does require differential reproduction. That's as good as definitive. But quasi-Darwinian evolution requires only differential persistence. Some things persist longer. That's not reproduction. They just persist longer in time than others, because they're harder than the things around them. Because they're, in some other way, they just hang around. They're not reproducing, but they're just staying, not alive, but staying existent in the form they're in. So what can differential persistence get you? Here's a few examples of weather-eroded rocks. Or how about this one? Can you see them? This is not very bright, but. And then, of course, the famous Cappadocia fairy chimneys, which is one name for them. That's in Turkey. And the way these were made was that there was volcanic eruptions which put deep volcanic ash, and then there was lava that came over the top, creating a sort of cake with a frosting. And the frosting is hard, and the cake is soft. And as rains come along, they erode through, and the water seeks, gravity, the water goes down, eroding as it goes, and the result is these amazing structures by the thousands in Cappadocia. It's it's an amazing sight. I had the good fortune. If you ever go to Cappadocia, you do want to do the hot air balloon trip. It's the best place in the world to do hot air ballooning. They have very reliable winds and very brilliant pilots who know how to. You've only got 1 degree of freedom, up, down. But they know how to use up and down so that they can go into canyons and down the ridges and into the next canyon. They can go around and then land the balloon on a trailer parked in a farmer's field 10 miles away. It's just amazing. And the sights are spectacular, as I say. Or how about this? The one on the left is an Andy Goldsworthy sculpture. He's one of my favorite sculptors. He does amazing natural sculptures. He works in rocks and leaves and mud and uses nature in all sorts of interesting ways. So the one on the left is an Andy Goldsworthy. That is an intelligent designer work. The one on the right, which sure looks like it might be an Andy Goldsworthy, in fact, is not. This was the cover of Science a few years ago. And this is Self-Organization of Sorted Patterned Ground by Kessler and Werner. And they, a few illustrations, there are varieties of sorted ground. The one that I showed you, the cover picture there, that's up in the Arctic. And it's the freezing-thawing cycle that does the trick there. This is one of their diagrams, the feedback processes that end up sorting the rocks. And just to prove their point, they did a computer program that simulated it, where they can set it up and just show that they've got the right do loops, and it runs and it sorts the rocks just fine. Here's sand sorted by size and density. You've all seen on a beach where the fine grains are in one place and the larger grains are another. These are interesting algorithmic processes. They're mindless, there's no purpose, but they have the very important effect of concentrating things of certain sorts. And what we want, if we want to get evolution going, is we want to have concentrations of things, sorting of things. That's the task to go to get from here to here. We want to have all these cycles working abiotically to create different things. Now, those are just geological examples. They're just much easier to visualize than the chemical cycles. Imagine the same thing going on at a completely different scale at the molecular level, and you begin to get some idea of what kind of changes in probability, rendering otherwise improbable events more and more probable, can occur. Now, gambits. What is a gambit? if you play chess, you know about gambits because there are all these named gambits in chess that have been studied by the chess masters. Officially, there are different definitions of gambit. It's just a move, a ploy, a tactic. But more specifically, it's a tactic which seems to be a step backwards. It seems to be a mistake. It's giving up a pawn, maybe even giving up a piece, but for tactical advantage. So it looks like, oops, you're giving up valuable material here. But sometimes that's the way to get ahead, to have a gambit. It always seems to be a step backwards or just step sideways. Seems to be a purposeless, pointless move given the task. The task in chess is checkmate. And there's lots of moves. If you look at a chessboard, you think, well, that's a stupid move. That doesn't advance my cause at all. And not progress of any sort. And so chess is an interesting model of adaptationism. It's a model of forgetful adaptationism. This is the way adaptationists tend to think. When they forget, they tend to have systematic blindness to gambits because they forget that evolution has no purpose, no foresight. It also has no shame and no time pressure. So the evolutionary exploration process tries all the bad moves too. Can't distinguish good moves from bad. And so it's very good at finding gambits. It's got no budget. Lose a few, win a few, lose 99 out of 100, it's okay. It doesn't care. It doesn't care about anything. And so evolution is a design process in which gambits are very likely to occur, and adaptationists trying to suss out the design of something, trying to figure it out, are very apt to overlook gambits, to be sort of systematically blind to gambits in their deliberations. Now, back to my diagram, same diagram. People working on origin of life realize that the job is to get from the lower left-hand corner to the upper right-hand corner. And they tend to think about this as which steps are progress. And life is short. You don't want to waste your time looking at things which look like they're not making any progress. And as a result, they tend to miss weird, off-the-wall, sideways moves, which turn out to be progress after all. This is an adaptationist foible. First of all, notice, you simply cannot do research on origin of life without adopting an adaptationist framework. You've got a clear goal. You've got to get up to that. You've got to get to a living thing from non-living. How on earth? You've got a problem to solve. You've got to come up with a sequence of steps which gets you from A to B, which solves your problem. And so people thinking in problem-solving mode, thinking like engineers, think, well, how on earth could I get there? And they think about how to put the steps together that take them. And maybe they think, well, let's see, we go this way, then 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 this way. And they tend not to think, well, let's go like that. And so they just don't think that way because it looks too expensive. In fact, of course, there are a lot of sideways constraints. Maynard Smith, way back in 1962, came up with a lovely example of sideways constraints, which I can't resist sharing with you because of a sort of curious anecdote. Many years later, Stephen Rose, in his book Lifelines, hit upon the same example and drew an entirely different moral from it. The example is a little solitaire game that you can play in English. I don't know if you can play it in Spanish. Maybe it would be very, very hard in Spanish, but not hard in English. It's to take two four-letter or five-letter or six-letter words and see if you can get from one to the other by making single changes at one letter only at a time. Here's how you can get from love to hate in just four moves. And there's other ways too, because lave is a word, so it could be love, lave, have, hate. So it's easy to get from love to hate in a nice direct path. However, if you want to get from mind to body, it takes a few more steps. You have to take a few sideways moves that are not going to end up in the finished product, like that R, and the E. And this is a fun game to play. I couldn't remember one. I tried to dream one up last night, and it was just too late. I had some pair of words which were five-letter words, and it took 11 or 12 moves to get all five of those letters changed. So you get the idea. It's an inefficient process which is governed by a constraint. This is a sideways move. Now, when Stephen Rose published his book, Lifelines, he was following in the tradition of Stephen Gould. He's sort of the British Gould wannabe. And he did, in his Lifelines book, he uses this example to say what's wrong with adaptationism. Is that adaptationists think there's always a direct path, and there isn't. This was an objection to adaptationism in general. I had a debate with Stephen after the book came out in German, in Gale, the German sort of Scientific American magazine, where I pointed out that Rose had taken his example from a paper written in 1962 by John Maynard Smith, dean of the adaptationists, the sort of number one adaptationist in the world. So I said it can hardly be an objection to adaptationism if it's John Maynard Smith who introduces it as an interesting constraint within adaptationism. And I had said that Rose had used this without attribution. He threatened to sue me if this was published. He's a very litigious man. He said he'd never seen the piece of Maynard Smith's. Very likely true, because it was not published in a regular journal. So I changed my text and said that Stephen Rose introduces this example because he doesn't know the literature of his field. So I couldn't be sued. I just couldn't resist telling you that story. You may think that very mean of me, but if you know Stephen Rose's work, you know that he is a hatchet man of great enthusiasm. I just want to illustrate gambit blindness at the highest levels in Origin of Life research. We don't need to worry about the details, it's just the shape of this that I want to draw your attention to. This is by Shostak, one of the leading figures in the field, writing a few years ago. For 40 years, efforts to understand the prebiotic synthesis of the ribonucleotide building blocks of RNA have been based on the assumption that they must have been assembled from the three molecular components: a nucleobase, adenine, guanine, cytosine, or uracil, this is RNA we're talking about, a ribose, sugar, and phosphate. So for 40 years, people working on this, trying to figure out some way to get these three things together. These are the three essential ingredients of RNA. You got to get these together, and then you can chain them up in a ladder. Of the many difficulties encountered by those in the field, the most frustrating has been the failure to find any way of properly joining the pyrimidine nucleobases, cytosine and uracil, to ribose. But Pounder et al. Revived the prospect of the RNA first model by exploring a pathway for pyrimidine ribonucleotide synthesis in which the sugar and nucleobase emerge from a common precursor. This is a sideways move with a vengeance. In this pathway, the complete nucleotide, ribonucleotide structure forms without using free sugar and nucleobase molecules as intermediates. This central insight, combined with a series of additional innovations, provides a remarkably efficient solution to the problem of prebiotic ribonucleotide synthesis. In other words, they missed that gambit for 40 years of going in what looked like the wrong direction, building something else from which you could streamline down to the parts put together that they needed. Okay, that's my example of gambit blindness in that field. As you might imagine, if I spend that much time on it, it's because I want to talk about gambit blindness in other places later on. So this, I said, is improbable. You come across this and you think, whoa, this is improbable. How much more improbable is this? A lot more improbable. If you think that this happened by the action of the surf, you're almost certainly mistaken. It could, in principle, happen, but the chances are pretty strong that it didn't. How are we going to get there? Well, let's look at evolution as an algorithm, a mindless sorting, changing process composed of do loops, reproductive cycles now. But the prebiotic world also had its algorithms. I want to look at that. We have, I suggest, gradually growing algorithmicity in that space where we have to get eventually to the Darwinian algorithms. We're going to get there by pre-Darwinian algorithms. First, we have parallel processing, many instances of the same process happening at once. You get that from the sorting that'll give you concentrations of the relevant things. So you get many, these are not copies of each other, they're just similar things happening at once. And that mass production turns gradually into mass reproduction. In other words, from differential persistence to differential reproduction. How does it happen? Here's where you have to start getting specific. Two terms from computers again, clobbering and serendipity. They're sort of mirror images of each other. Clobbering is when you have one subroutine or algorithm and another one, and they're running contiguously and simultaneously, and one of them is undoing the work of the other, somehow interfering. That's clobbering. So when computer programmers write programs, they're very careful to insulate, to isolate elements. It's usually just a matter of declaring variables and so forth, but so that you don't get clobbering. Otherwise, you have to discover a bug in a program where you hadn't realized that one was going to interfere with the operation of the other. That's clobbering. Serendipity is, as it were, good clobbering. It's when the result of an interference turns out to be helpful rather than not. evolution depends a lot on serendipity. So it's a good thing that evolution, unlike human intelligent design by computer programmers, doesn't insulate in order to avoid clobbering to anywhere near the degree it does, but it doesn't do it to the same degree. Why? Because it doesn't have any purpose or any intention or any shame or any budget. It just lets all things happen so that you get a lot more chances for serendipity at the cost of a lot more clobbering. Now, so if we want to look at algorithms at the molecular level, what has been realized by many theorists is that a membrane is a clobbering preventer. Before you're going to get a living thing, you're going to have a lot of machinery in there that isn't going to be clobbered by whatever's going on outside. So you have to insulate it, but you want to have a semi-permeable memory because you have to get some stuff in and some stuff out, and you're going to have to be able to control what gets in and what gets out, but mainly you want to protect what's inside. So a membrane is one of the fundamental architectural requirements for living things. Fortunately, membranes can form prebiotically, lipid membranes are natural formations that can occur and multiply under some conditions. And that permits cycles to operate without interference. You remember the two prokaryotes coming together and forming a union. Will now go down to the prebiotic and imagine a little bit of cycling, a proto-metabolism cycle, which is in danger of being clobbered before it can do anything, but somehow finding its way inside a protective membrane, and we're beginning to get closer to home. Now, inside cells, we've got the Krebs cycle and thousands of other cycles. We've eventually got to get all of those packed inside. And Tibor Ganti wrote in Hungarian years ago, and Ersz Zathmári is a big proponent, a fellow Hungarian. Ganti wrote in 71, and I think it was only in the last 10 years that this has been translated into English. This is the chemoton. This is Ganti's idealization, an engineer's idealization of the simplest possible self-reproducing entity. So this is like an artificial bacterium. So what do we have? We have a membrane-forming system. We have a metabolic system, and we have a genetic system. You got to capture energy, you got to have a genetic copying system, and you got to have a membrane-forming system. And these create the membrane, which is permeable, and he has many other diagrams that go with this. This is just his basic diagram. Other people have hit on something like Ganti's idea. He's not the only one who's thought of it in these terms. He's done a lot of the really simplifying work. Now, I see my next slide doesn't have the reveal that I'm usually put on these, so you get it all at once, but we'll walk through it. You know, I didn't go through all my slides this morning, but here we go. Now, don't make the mistake of thinking that the first bacterium was the simplest. I myself make this mistake. Everybody makes this mistake. They think, all right, the first living thing must have been a dead simple bacterium. You got to be simple before you can be complex. No, no, no. Not true. Maybe the first things that could actually reproduce were the most inefficient, ungodly, complex monstrosities. That did they reproduce? Well, it was hard to say. They reproduced. Maybe it took a year to reproduce. And it wasn't really, was it really reproduction? You can't be sure. This is This is where the gambits come in. If you think you've got to get to the simplest first, you're very likely mistaken. I was going to illustrate this by having side by side my cell phone and the first, you know, portable phones, you know, these great clunky things. In human engineering, often you start with what later look like laughably complicated, heavy energy using systems, which get refined and refined and refined and refined and refined. And if you start recognizing that in the prebiotic era, first of all, there wasn't much competition, you could take your jolly good time reproducing. But if you did actually reproduce, then Darwinian evolution gets off the ground, because now you have progeny which obey the Darwinian algorithm, and you can get things underway. And then you'll get the competitive refinement, streamlining, rendering ever more efficient. And there's beautiful examples known about, for instance, enzymatic catalytic cycles, which started out at one efficiency and are now thousands of times more efficient than they were when they started. Once you recognize that we've got a morass of hyper-complicated, inefficient, prodigious energy-using systems, then we no longer have to think about getting to that streamlined, simplest bacterium. You know, we have Craig Venter and his colleagues removing genes from bacteria to see what the simplest living form they can get is. It's an interesting exercise, but if you think, oh, they're trying to reverse engineer to get to the first living thing, that's probably just wrong. When they get it and they decide this is the simplest thing that can be alive, it's the simplest Gonti chematon, but that doesn't mean it was the first living thing. We want to get to the, so that even the category of being alive, we want to be gradualist about that and see that you could have very, by, you know, in a retrospect, second-rate elegance of design, which gets reproduction going, and then we're off to the races. So now, persistence gives things extra time to pick up revisions and adjustments. In that way, it's like reproduction. It's sort of reproduction in time. And so reproduction is, in a way, just a special kind of persistence. It's the creation of tokens of types, which can, in parallel, explore different corners of the world. Don't put all your eggs in one basket is the first axiom of population thinking. Now, look what the next slide says. Thanks for your attention. Tomorrow, the evolution of reasons.